That was quick, thank you.
Okay. All right. I'd like to welcome all of you to the first lecture of Ling 101, Introduction to Language and Linguistics. At the moment, this is very dark. Don't worry, the next slide is going to be much brighter. Can you hear me? I mean, is the microphone working all right? Am I too loud? Am I okay? A bit louder. Well, let's see what happens if I put this higher up. Is that better? Not yet. Let's see. How about now? Better? Better. Okay. All right. If at some stage you stop hearing me, please just sort of start waving and then I'll see what I can do. Okay. Yes. This lecture is also being recorded, and this is why this equipment is here. So we'll work it out. This is the first lecture. Okay. Right. I'll start with some contact information. I'll give you a lot more information about requirements and assignments and things like that in a minute. But I thought I'd first let you know who I am. My name is Sebastian Hoffmann. I'm responsible. I'm one of the linguistics people in the department. If you want to find me personally, then I can be found in room 344 in the B building. I can also, and perhaps most easily, be reached by email. My email address is hoffmann@uni-trier.de, and I have office hours. I have office hours every Wednesday from 9 to 11. Okay. I say this at the very, very beginning of the lecture, because last year, I think, this is my second year at the University of Trier, I think last year perhaps maybe a handful of students came to see me during the semester, and I'm not quite sure why. Okay, maybe you didn't need to, that's one option, but I just want to invite you, if there are any questions that are obviously related to the linguistics lecture, then this is actually where you can find me. At the moment, the sign-up is sort of very traditionally on a piece of paper, which is hanging on my office door. I'm currently investigating the option of having this done via StudIP. I've been told that there is a plugin which makes this possible, but it's not installed yet. So maybe in a few days or weeks, I'll be able to be a bit more modern. But at the moment, you have to sign up by going to my office door. Okay. If you're coming from very far, well, no, during term it should be no problem. Okay. Otherwise, you can also send me an email. Right, but I said I'd really like to not just bore you with practicalities, assignments, exams, okay, things like that. But I'd really like to start with doing linguistics. Okay. I'd like to, there's plenty of space in the middle if you don't want to sit on the, okay, there's, you're welcome to sit there, but I just thought, anyway, I'd like to start with doing some real linguistics with you. I'd like to ask the question, what is linguistics, and why study it? Experience from last year, from the group of students that I taught last year, has taught me that many of you are not, well, you have some idea about what linguistics is, but you don't quite know what's in store for you. So I'd like to mention that today. I'd like to give you an overview. I'd like to give you an overview over the different fields, most of which we will be covering in this first semester. As you probably know, there will be a second semester, another introduction to linguistics, which will then cover a number of additional topics, which I will not have time to go into. So what you're getting today is a little bit like going to the cinema and getting a trailer for what's going to come when you go to the cinema next time. Or I could call it a teaser. You're going to get a bit of a preview of what's ahead for you. I'll also very briefly mention or ask the very basic question, what is language? Okay. We're not going to answer this conclusively today, but I thought I'd mention it anyway. And then after doing that, this should probably take me about an hour, maybe a little bit less, maybe a little bit more. Let's see. I will go into all the nitty-gritty of what you have to do and when you have to do it. And I will say something about the exam, because that's the usual question in the first lecture. When will the exam be? What will the exam be like? Etc., etc. Okay. But as I said, I'd like to do this not at the very beginning. Okay, so let's start with what is linguistics and why study it? Why are you sitting here apart from that it's part of the module and that you just basically are forced to do this if you want to study English at the university? Well, a very brief answer would be it is the scientific study of natural language. Natural as opposed to, let's say, computer languages or something like that. A scientific study. What does scientific mean? Well, let's see. Okay. I've got a nice quote here for you. Language is the most fundamental human capacity. As such, studying language is one avenue to studying the workings of the human mind. So in a way, by studying language, this quote claims, we are actually learning something about what's going on in our brains when we, for example, produce language. Linguists are interested in language for its own sake, as well as in what the study of language can tell us about the mind and in how an understanding of the true nature of language can inform practical issues such as language teaching, the treatment of language disorders, and language policy. Can I just have a show of hands? How many of you are going to be language teachers? How many do you want? Right, yes, exactly. Yeah. So, we're doing linguistics. We're looking at linguistics not only, but also because we think it's going to be good for your future career. But, well, I've highlighted something here, the most fundamental human capacity. It is really fundamental to our being, our sort of being a human being. Okay? Let me exemplify this a little bit further. Here's another quote. Many of our daily activities are carried out with language. Most of the time, we are not aware of the language we are using. The study of language is interesting because it is important for our relationships, for managing our daily life, for our study, and for doing things together. The study of linguistics helps us to become more aware of our use of language. It assists greatly in the learning and the teaching of languages. Okay. Same point again at the very end, but basically it claims that much of our lives and also in a way much of our identity, who you are and who you pretend to be, okay, who you are in connection with your social partners, friends, acquaintances, teachers, etc., is pretty much defined or at least very, very heavily influenced by the language you use, how you use it, etc., how often you use it, what you use, etc. So that's why it is one of the fundamental properties of human beings. And that's why I find it interesting, and I hope I can share some of that interest with you. Now, many of you will be interested in English literature. Many of you will probably have come to university because you liked English literature at school. Okay. Now, and I'm not just saying this because I'm a linguist, okay, but I really think that there is sense in doing linguistics for people who are doing literature. For example, if you are interested in stylistic aspects of a particular literary work, okay, how does, for example, well, how is the language of Shakespeare special? Why is it special? And what exactly is special about the linguistic aspects? And how can this be related to whatever happens in the third act of Romeo and Juliet, for example? Okay. Now, stylistics is the study, or is the branch of linguistics which sort of branches into literature. We're not going to do a lot of stylistics proper, but I still believe, yes, please switch off your mobile phones. we're going to be, alright, now I lost my thread. But anyway, I guess you got the point. Literature and linguistics do have something to inform each other, okay? And I mean each other. I also think that the study of literature is relevant for what we're doing in linguistics. Right. This is where the teaser starts, or the preview, or the trailer, whatever you want to call it. A brief overview of things to come. Can I just ask what you eat with, well, what is it? Goatee? Goatee? I don't know. Some of you will probably know, yes.
Fish.
You eat fish with goatee?
Yeah.
No. You eat chips with goatee, no? Yes. That's what you meant, of course. Yes. You eat chips with goatee. Why? Can anyone? I'll give you 20 seconds to think about that. Can you read this, by the way? Is it bright enough? I can make the room darker, but yes. Yes. It's supposed to mean fish, it's supposed to sound like fish. Okay, right. If we take the GH from laugh, the O from women, we, he, and the TI from nation, then the word goatee can be pronounced fish. Okay? Makes perfect sense, right? So we can come to the conclusion that English spelling is, or at least seems to be, rather odd and seemingly illogical. Now, of course, this is nonsense. This is not the way it works. A word that is spelt G-H-O-T-I could not possibly, at least in English, a lot of things are possible in the 5,999 other languages that people know of on the planet, be pronounced the same way as we pronounce fish. And we can give good explanations as to why this is the case. For example, we can observe, we can see this in other words in the English language, that GH, the sort of letter combination GH, at the beginning of words is never pronounced F. So there are rules. It's not that English pronunciation and English spelling, or rather spelling as a reflection of pronunciation, is chaotic. It may sometimes seem a little bit, but there are rules. In fact, there are quite a few other rules. Rules or regularities, tendencies, but very strong tendencies, about what's possible and what's not possible. If you speak a language like Vietnamese, for example, then you have absolutely no problem starting a word in "ng". But if you speak English, you can't do that. You do not have words starting in "ng". We can also make the following observation. The words "black" and "light" could exist. There's nothing wrong with them as, well, from the point of view of the rules of the English language, or of the regularities of the English language. They just don't happen to be regular words of the English language. But there are other words which clearly cannot possibly exist because they are not compatible with those rules. We cannot have a word that is stwant, or whatever you would, however you would pronounce it, slenk, or gopik, or I don't, I'm not quite sure how to pronounce these, okay, because they are not compatible with certain rules about which combinations of consonants are possible in particular positions of words in English. Now, the fish example and this example of these words which are or are not possible in English are just examples of what we do when we do phonetics and phonology. There is more to it, but I wanted to give you those two examples. Here is a definition of what we do in phonetics and phonology. It's the areas of linguistics that deal with the scientific study of speech processes, that is phonetics, and the study of the sound system of a particular language. We are going to do phonetics and phonology in lectures 3 and 4. So that's fairly early on in the lecture. Right, let's move on to the next field. I don't know, most of you may know this, or many of you do. Humpty Dumpty sat on a wall. Humpty Dumpty had a great fall. all the king's horses and all the king's men couldn't put Humpty together again. Okay? Something that I guess most children, if not all children in the English-speaking world know, and many of you will probably have heard this as well. I will use this for at least two examples today, but the first question I would like to ask you is, how many words are there in the last two lines? I'll just give you a moment to count this. Okay. How many have you got? Yeah. 70. Okay. 11. 15. Okay. Can you not count? Or what's going on here? Yeah. 16? Okay. Right. Okay. You're not giving me, I'm sure there are good reasons for giving me all the other figures, but you're the first person to say because, okay? I've got here 14, 15, 12, 11, I didn't have 17, I'm not quite sure, but it doesn't really matter, okay? The real answer, I think, is, and that is something which happens very often in linguistics, it depends, okay? It depends on how you count. It depends on what you define a word to be. The question, what is a word, is in fact not a very trivial question. If you define a word as a sequence of non-white space characters delimited by white space or by a space, okay, then you have one definition of word and you will come to the conclusion that we have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, etc. Right? But that's really only one way of counting. You could, for example, and I think some of those who counted, who arrived at lower figures, probably counted different word forms rather than different sequences of non-white space characters. Okay? For example, we've got king twice. Okay? So if you ask the question how many different words, then it's a different answer, of course. Okay? And then, as you rightly mentioned, what do you do with couldn't? Is that one word or is it two words? It is could not, of course, and we've got a contraction which is attached or which is linked up in some way with the word could. For the computer who has the definition sequence of non-white space characters, this is one word. But for us, perhaps, or for human beings who know that this is could and the negator not, it's just contracted, it would perhaps make sense to say, no, these are two words. You could even ask the question, how many of these words do you find in a dictionary in this form? And then you would find, again, a different number of words. Okay? Or, for example, if you have the word king, and then later on you have the word kings, not with an apostrophe, but just as a plural, is that the same word? Well, it's two different word forms of the same dictionary entry in a way. Right, now this is one aspect, there are many more again, of what we're doing when we look at morphology. The identification, analysis, and description of the structure of words. In fact, in morphology, what I've basically asked here is how many different words, but I have not really gone into the structure of, or the internal structure of words. Okay, I have with couldn't, could and not. But in fact, there are words which are made up of individual, smaller, meaningful units. Okay. Lecture theater, for example. Is lecture and theater, well, is that two words? Is it one word? It's a compound. Okay. When we talk about things like that, we are doing morphology. We will be concerned with morphology after the two lectures on phonetics and phonology. That's when we will be looking at the words of the English language and their internal structure and the rules that can be observed by which these words are put together. Okay. Or, for example, in what way new vocabulary is added to the language by way of those word formation rules. Okay, let's get back to Humpty Dumpty. I won't read it again, okay, but there is a fall, right? Couldn't put Humpty together again. Poor Humpty Dumpty, you could say, right? This is really bad. Okay. And in fact, some people felt it was really bad. I mean, who is the recipient of this nursery rhyme? Well, it's children. Poor children. How can they be exposed to something as nasty as this? Okay. About a year ago, just before I gave this lecture for the first time here in Trier, I found this on the BBC News, and I'll read this to you. Nursery rhyme violence tops TV. Nursery rhymes expose children to far more violent incidents than an average evening watching TV, researchers say. A Bristol Royal Hospital for Children team found the frequency of nursery rhyme violence was more than 10 times greater than in pre-9 PM programs. The tongue-in-cheek study examined 25 popular rhymes, archives of disease in childhood reported. Examples of violent incidents included Humpty Dumpty being hurt in a fall and Jack and Jill tumbling down a hillside. The researchers admit their study was not entirely serious, but they say it does make the point that blaming television for increasing levels of violence is too simplistic. The researchers gathered data from TV regulator Ofcom on depiction of violence over a two-week period in 2001 in the viewing period between 5:30 and 9 PM. Okay. Right. So the claim is here that, well, the tongue-in-cheek claim, or the not-quite-so-serious claim, that exposing children to these, to this example of language, basically, to this nursery rhyme, could potentially have detrimental effects on them. Could be bad for them. Now, again, this is of course partly nonsense, but I would like to use this example to make a special point and to introduce yet another field of linguistics. But first, here is a reaction that I found on the web while I was researching this last year. Someone, and again, this is perhaps not 100% serious, but still, this person wrote in response to someone getting really worked up about this and said, this is nonsense, etc. Actually, it makes sense. Humpty is a blatant sexual reference. Okay? There is to hump in there, so Humpty, yeah, must be about sex. Okay? Dumpty, this is street slang for excrement. Yeah? Okay. As I said, this is not 100% serious, right? But it helps me make a point. Okay. Sat on a wall, obvious reference to the psychedelically inspired movie album by Pink Floyd. Humpty Dumpty had a great fall. This is a continuing reference to the experience one might have of crashing after partaking in illegal substances. All the king's horses and all the king's men. Phrasing of this statement suggests a relationship between the two parties mentioned, the undertones of which could be evocative of bestiality. Okay. And this one, I have to admit, I don't get myself. Couldn't put Humpty back together again. Something so nasty and profane, I can't post it here. If you can enlighten me, please. Maybe not in front of everyone, but anyway. There seems to be something that... I've asked a few native speakers, they couldn't help me either. But anyway. So the conclusion is, yeah, this is clearly no good for children. Such filth. But the point I can make with this, I think, is this. Words have different types of meanings. There are primary referential meanings, but we have connotations, or we have sort of... Okay, the word dump can mean lots of things. Okay? It can also mean something not so nice for children, perhaps, or hump. Okay, but hump has completely different meanings as well. Okay? And in fact, those meanings seem to be additional layers on the basis or on top of the basic referential meaning. Now, when we look at things like this, we're doing semantics. The study of meaning, or the study of meanings in language. Okay. I'd like to stay with Humpty Dumpty, sorry. Here's another one. People seem to be really concerned with Humpty Dumpty. Humpty Dumpty given a happy ending by politically correct BBC. This was something that happened also last year. The other one I think was older. This was last year. The BBC was yesterday accused of outrageous political correctness as changing the words to a nursery rhyme on a children's show. CBBS program Something Special altered the words to Humpty Dumpty and gave it a more cheerful ending. Instead of being unable to put Humpty together again, the new version claimed all the king's horses and all the king's men made Humpty happy again. I very much doubt that any child has in the slightest been traumatized by Humpty Dumpty and any other age-old nursery rhyme, said John, etc., etc. This is an unnecessary and outrageous piece of political correctness directed at young children. Political correctness is, of course, another, we could say, is it semantics? Yes, but it's perhaps also a bit more than semantics. Okay? And there are many terms that have been singled out as being politically incorrect. Okay, perhaps the most or the best known is the word nigger. Okay, even pronouncing the word nigger aloud nowadays in an English-speaking country will send shivers down the spine of many people. Okay, you're supposed to say African American. In fact, originally, for only a short period, I have to say, nigger was a neutral, or was intended to be a neutral term, if that was possible in those sort of sociocultural circumstances. It was then bad for a long time afterwards. Then the next term was negro, okay, which was actually the standard denomination up to about the middle of the 20th century. Nowadays, again, this is also non-PC. Then black came into fashion. We've got the Black Power movement in the sort of 1960s. And African American, which is, I think, still the sort of neutral term today, is in use, or has been in use since the late 60s, and it became particularly common after Jesse Jackson's nomination campaign in 1988. So quite clearly things have changed in terms of the meaning of this word, or of these words, but also of the, not only connotations, but the kind of things using these words in a conversation do, quite literally. Okay, if I say, if I utter the word nigger in a normal conversation, then this actually does something. Okay. You're not supposed to say fireman, you're supposed to say firefighter. This is probably going a bit too far, but some people are quite serious about this. You're not supposed to say blind, you're supposed to say visually challenged. This is typically given as an example of how far this can go. Okay. And there are many others. Okay. So we can, in a way, do things with language. Okay. We can, for example, insult someone with language. Okay. Now, if I went here and sort of, who shall I single out, say, you are an idiot. Okay. Then, now you know there is something I'm doing with this. But usually, in the normal circumstances, you would probably feel assaulted. Or verbally assaulted or offended or something like that. Because this is sort of a standard offense, okay, calling someone an idiot. But does that have to be the case? Can I call someone an idiot? No. Can I say to someone, you are an idiot, without wanting to offend that person? Mm-hmm. Okay, there could be an ironic use. For example, between friends, it might even mean you're cool, okay, perhaps, all right, good, yeah. Can you think of another situation? Yeah?
Can we get on serious right now? Are
you crazy? Okay, which is probably still going in the same direction of actually calling someone an idiot. It's probably related, but yes, there are shades of meaning, I fully agree. Think of someone staging a play. Okay, now, you're the king, you're the queen, you're an idiot as well, and whatever. Okay, if there is a role of an idiot, okay, a jester or something like that, okay, and then it's just basically a statement, basically conferring this role onto that person. Now, I'm using the same words but it has a completely different meaning. Okay? You could look at this one. I suggest that you see a psychiatrist immediately. Can be very offensive. Okay? If said by, let's say, your GP, by your general physician, by your doctor, then it'll be different. You probably may not feel too happy about this anyway, but it has a different effect on you. It is not an offense as such. Okay? So, context, really, is the decisive factor in what the actual meaning of the utterance is. Okay. I have something which exemplifies this, but this is not very PC, so don't take it personal. It's not meant as an insult to anyone, like women or, yeah. Let's see. Okay. When a diplomat says yes, he means perhaps. When he says perhaps, he means no. When he says no, he's not a diplomat. Okay? When a lady says no, she means perhaps. When she says perhaps, she means yes. When she says yes, she is not a lady. Now, don't blame me. This is apparently said by Voltaire. I'm not sure. But that doesn't really matter. And it, as I said, I'm not trying to insult any... I was going to say the 50% in the audience who are female, but it's probably a larger percentage who are female. But the point really is context and meaning interact. It is possible for different speakers in different circumstances to mean different things using the same words. You can insult someone with the same words as assigning a particular role might do with those words. And that's when we are talking about the study of pragmatics. So, study of the aspects of meaning and language used that are dependent on the speaker, the addressee, and other features of the context of the utterance, or context of utterance. Right, let me get back to another, to a point which I've made earlier. Okay, the N-word. Okay. Is it really true that you can't use the N-word anymore? Again, it depends. It really depends on who you are. For example, I wasn't the biggest nigger in the world. I couldn't beat everybody, but my rep superseded me. Here is a black rap musician saying it. Okay? And it's actually used among, now what's the PC term? African-American people as some kind of in-group term. Okay? And it's not meant as an insult at all. So it really depends not just on the context alone in the sense of, who you are. It depends on who you talk to as well. Here's another example. Who do you think uses the word lovely in British English? Well, everyone can use it, but yes?
Old ladies.
Old ladies. Okay. Is that everyone's feeling? Okay. Well, let's have a look. The source of data is something that you will probably encounter later on in your studies if you continue for the full 3 or whatever many years at the University of Trier. It's the British National Corpus. The British National Corpus is a 100 million word collection of present-day English. Well, present-day in the sense of last millennium, really, but 1980s and 1990s, mostly. Okay. It's British English only, and the makers of the BNC say that it is a unique snapshot of the English language as it is used at that particular time. Okay. This is a more reliable source than introspection. When I asked you who uses lovely, then you applied your knowledge of language or of what you heard British people say and came to the conclusion that it's elderly ladies. Okay. Now, when we look at those large collections of texts, then we do corpus linguistics. We use a large corpus of texts to look at patterns and try to make sense of these patterns. Okay. So what we can find, for example, is these frequencies. Okay, we corpus linguists like to count things. Okay. We can, for example, see that the oldest men, male speakers, and the youngest men use lovely with about the same frequency. Okay, 179, 188, these are per million words. So in other words, if you take a random subset from the corpus of 1 million words, you are likely to find about 180 in them. Okay? Not exactly, but this is sort of a normalized frequency. Now what about the women? Okay? Notice that, I mean, these are much, much higher. Let me just go back here. I mean, they're all below 200. Yeah? So it's not just the elderly ladies, okay? It's the young ladies as well, okay? Even the teenagers use it more often than the men, apparently. But look at the elderly ones. I mean, we have a huge difference, and it's actually almost clearly the case. Well, all right, those two are clearly, well, they're a bit swapped, but, I mean, they're very, very close together. We basically see the more they advance in age, the more women apparently use lovely. We could actually make a nice graph out of this, something that we also do in corpus linguistics. So some aspects of language are used more or less often by certain groups of people. In this case, elderly ladies versus, well, pretty much everyone else, but still. Okay. And when we look at things like this, what people would use in certain circumstances when they have a choice. Okay. Perhaps where an elderly lady would say, lovely, a 20-year-old man would say, I don't know, cool or wicked or I don't know. Okay. So when we do the study of language variation, then we do social linguistics. Okay. Here I've got a quote from Wikipedia, and I've actually indicated that I've taken this from Wikipedia, partly to take this as an opportunity to warn you to use Wikipedia without thinking about what you see there. A lot of things can be found on Wikipedia that are great and good. We generally don't like it when Wikipedia is the only source of your work at university. But not generally. Scratch the word generally. We don't like it. Okay. But it's often a very, very good source for information. I think I agree with the definition here. The study of the effect of any and all aspects of society, including cultural norms, expectations, and context on the way language is used. Okay, next field of linguistics. Do sentences grow on trees? Well, in linguistics, yes, sort of. Okay, but they're funny trees. Let's have a look at the sentence, sentences grow on trees. I'm sure all of you agree that if you compare this with grow sentences trees on, then there is something wrong in the second case. One is structured okay, and the other one isn't. One is idiomatic English, the other one isn't. It may actually be the case that in a different language, that order of elements would be perfectly okay to express the kind of thing that sentences grow on trees does in English. Now, if we were to shuffle things around a little bit and add other words, etc., then we would find out that some parts of the sentence seem to sort of belong together. For example, on trees, I think you can agree with me, belongs together, forms a unit. But that unit is then contained in yet another unit, namely, you don't see this very well, I wonder whether the... This should be green, just think green. Okay. Grow on trees is a higher unit, so to speak, which contains the unit on trees. Okay. We can visualize this with, yes, a tree. Okay. Sentences grow on trees, we can say, all right, the first one is a noun, the second one is a verb, the third one is a preposition, and then we have another tree. And we can go up one level and say some of those elements form phrases. We'll look into this in more detail. And those, okay, this on trees here is actually a preposition phrase, which is part of the verb phrase, grow on trees. Okay. And all of this together is one sentence. Okay. And then we have a tree. It's a bit of a funny tree because it's upside down, but it's a tree. Okay. So, yes, sentences do grow on trees in linguistics. Syntax. The study of the principles and rules for constructing sentences in natural languages. And we will be doing quite a bit of syntax. In fact, we will have 4 lectures on syntax. Just one additional point on syntax. Can you read this for yourself? Or this one? Or perhaps this one? Right? Something is odd here, right? You start reading and then you realize, nope, I have to start again. I have to go back. Okay, it's led me down the wrong path in the garden. Okay, I have to retrace my steps and then start again from where I must have turned wrong, took the wrong turning. Okay, these are so-called garden path sentences because the mind seems to be set to expect certain things. The man whistling tunes, well, tunes must be a noun because that's what you do to, that's what you whistle. Okay, but this is actually the man who is whistling tunes, pianos. Okay? Right? And the same is true for the other examples. So, things like that have to do with syntax. Let's move on to the next area. What's the meaning of silence? Okay. For example, if someone, let's imagine there are 2 people standing in front of a Picasso painting. And then A says, God, isn't this picture awful? And the second person doesn't say anything. Do you agree that this is sort of an indication that this is, no, I quite actually like that picture, okay, or that painting. Again, of course, context. So does silence mean disagreement? I'm getting fat. Right? Okay. So, again, of course, context is everything, but it also means that silence can actually have a communicative function. It means something, or it can mean something. What A says is the first part of a pair. And this is partly because we're expecting conversation to be structured. If I ask you a question, then you will expect a response. No, I will, sorry. If I ask you a question, then I will expect a response, and you're likely to give it to me. And if you don't give me a response, then you will probably explain to me why you don't give me a response. Okay. It's very common to respond to a greeting with yet another greeting. Okay. And these are very, very typical for what's going on in everyday conversation. Okay. And when we look at this, then we are doing conversation or discourse analysis. That's again something that we will do in this term. It's something that will happen quite late in the term. What's the difference between a skirt and a shirt? Time. Okay? Both words go back to the same word in a language spoken before English existed. Shirt presumably entered the British Isles with the Anglo-Saxons and the Jutes, but there is only one somewhat doubtful use in an old English manuscript, and skirt was then brought onto the British Isles later with the Viking invasions, and it's basically the same word but different meanings, and so in a way you could say that the difference between skirt and shirt, well, it's of course something different, but it's related to something to do with when it entered the language. When we look at things like this, then we're doing historical linguistics. We're looking at, for example, the etymology, the history of the words, and we're looking at how language contact with, let's say, invaders or for other reasons, well, contact between people, different peoples, for various reasons, and how this has an impact on the language. And particularly for English, this was a very important factor in the development of English, various types of influences over the period of more than 1,000 years. There are other examples like knight. What is knight today? A knight is something, it's a member of the aristocracy. Okay. This was originally actually pronounced Knecht. And this is very close to the German, or it's actually the same word as the word Knecht. Okay. So you can see that also in terms of semantic change, interesting things happen. The word silly, which is has negative connotations or can be used to offend someone, is actually related to the German word selig. Selig. Okay. So, quite a lot of interesting things there to do and to look at in historical linguistics. I have to say that because I'm partly a historical linguist, so this is what I do when I don't teach introduction to linguistics often. Right. So that was a brief overview of many of the fields that you're going to encounter over the next 15 weeks, 14 weeks. As I said, social linguistics is something that is going to be covered next term, but most of the things that I mentioned will actually be dealt with in this lecture course. I have a definition of language here from one of the old linguists, Edward Sapir. Language is a purely human and non-instinctive method of communicating ideas, emotions, and desires by means of a system of voluntarily produced symbols. These symbols are, in the first instance, auditory, and they are produced by the so-called organs of speech. And it then goes on. This is one way of looking at language, but I think the important bit as an introduction to what's going to come next is language is a purely human and non-instinctive method of communicating ideas, emotions, and desires. Is language really purely human? Do animals not communicate? I have gerbils at home, Rennmäuse. Okay. Now, quite clearly, their way of communication is somewhat different from human. But, I don't know, they keep gnawing on their cage, and I'm not sure whether this is purely instinctive. Are they telling me they want to get out? They certainly want. Are they telling me when they're hungry? Is this the same thing as communication between human beings? Well, quite obviously not, but is it really completely different? And, okay, little gerbils are one thing, but what about gorillas, chimpanzees, dolphins, elephants, etc.? Do we have anything that suggests in their way of behavior that this is actually communication in the same sense as we talk to each other? Okay. Now, I wanted to mention this in today's lecture because that's basically what we're going to discuss next lecture. We will be looking at the properties of human language. Okay. And I put human in brackets here because we will actually be looking at some of the communication patterns or some of the aspects of animal communication and use this to come up with features that are really unique to human interaction. So we'll be looking at both. So, in other words, we'll be looking at human versus animal communication. I will also be introducing a few, if I manage, concepts, a few very basic concepts of linguistics alongside. Okay, I said I was going to take about an hour. I didn't quite take an hour, it took 50 minutes, but this is the time to now get into some of the practical matters. Okay. And if I finish a little bit early, then I'll let you go off a little bit early. Okay, I'll give you 2 minutes to have a breather, but don't run off, okay? You won't hold up. Just 2 minutes.
we just wanted to know if we had to do the assignment and the we read it and registered, but we had all the
Shall we start again? Right. Okay. I personally find 1.5 hours quite a long time for you to sit there and listen. So, and it's also sometimes a long time to be standing here and talking all the time. But I will try to not introduce breaks as such where everyone can run off and have a drink and smoke a cigarette or something like that. I think that would take too long. Okay, but I would like to sort of usually have at least some kind of breather in between or an exercise where you can talk to each other for a minute or something like that. Okay. Because 1.5 hours is long. I used to teach in the north of England at Lancaster University, and lectures there were 50 minutes long. Okay. I think that's a much more sort of feasible length when it comes to the attention span of the average human being. Okay. But lectures in Trier are 1.5 hours, so we'll be doing a 1.5 hour lecture. Okay. Right, some practical information. I'd like to stress that this is a lecture for absolute beginners. Many of you are first year, first term students. Okay. And this is meant for you. Okay. I know that there are quite a few students in here who are more advanced students because they want to revise the material for the exams, etc., and that's fine. I just want to let those people know that it is it's a lecture for absolute beginners. Okay. So just don't expect this to be in any way advanced. The thing I have to say, though, in this context is that sometimes I will be saying things, I will be giving you information that I will not expect you to know for the exam. Okay? I will actually sometimes be a little bit more advanced than just beginner's level. Okay? This is partly because I think these are interesting aspects of linguistics. And some of you will know a little bit more and they may feel interested in this. Okay. So one of the tasks for you will be to filter out what is important and what is not, and I am going to help you with this. Towards the end of the course, perhaps even sort of somewhere in the middle, you're going to get a list of keywords from me, which lists all the words that are, or all the concepts that are important in boldface. Okay, for every lecture. And everything that's in boldface, you really must know and understand and be actively able to use. Okay. Then there will be a list of words that are not in boldface, but just in normal font. These ones are the words that you should sort of understand, those concepts you should understand, but perhaps not be fully, not be able to use fully actively. Or you will not be expected to know all the detail. Okay. And then there are words and concepts that are in brackets. And these are really the extras. And I will not be expecting you to know this even passively. But if you do, that's fine. Okay? So, last year there were a few issues that some people felt I was putting too much content into the course. Okay. That's why I would like to mention this very early on. I'm not going to reduce the content, okay, but I hope to make it clearer what's useful, well, not useful, what's necessary for you to know and what isn't. Now, this is a required class or a required lecture if you are a BA English Language, Linguistics and Literature as a major, or BA English Language and Linguistics as a minor. And this is also a required class if you are a B.Ed. English student, both Realschule and Gymnasium. Now, you may have already seen that depending on what you are, I mean, which of those three degree schemes you belong to, you get different credit points, Leistungspunkte, for this. And they depend on various things. And Leistungspunkte, as you know, credit points, relate to the number of hours that you're supposed to or expected to spend on whatever tasks we give you. Okay. And the credit points you get for this course depend on, they consist of various things. The basic preparatory reading for everybody and attendance. Okay. If you are a BA major, you'll get some extra reading to do because you get more points. Okay. And we would like to take this into account by giving you more to read. There will be an STS assignment. STS stands for Study and Transferable Skills. Okay. STS assignment, which covers skills you're likely to need regardless of what you do in your future. Okay. In the case here, it will be a library exercise. You will be asked to look for certain things in the library to show that you know how to use the library. Okay. It's pretty basic, really. Okay. Everyone is expected to do this. It is part of your credit points that you get for this lecture. And then there will be a second assignment. Now, this is only for the BA students. If you're a BEd student, you do not have to do it. Okay. However, you are very welcome to do it. You're very welcome to do it, and I will look at it, and I will mark it, and I will return it to you, because it will be one of the many ways, or one of the, how many I still have to see, but one of the many ways in which you can assess your own progress. Because, I won't say the because yet. I'll say that in a minute. Okay. Right. Another way that helps you, or that is supposed, or that is set up so that you can get additional input, is that there will be 5 tutorials, okay, accompanying tutorials. They are not compulsory. Okay. I highly recommend that you attend them. Okay. But if you can't, or if you don't want, it will have no influence on the credit points you get, etc. One very important point I would like to make at the outset. These tutorials, and I'm saying this because of what happened last year, these tutorials are not a replacement for the lecture. You are not expected, it's not going to be like if you go to the tutorial and go to the tutorial teacher and say, "Now, what did he say in the lecture? Can you just summarize that for me?" Okay. They were explicitly instructed not to do this. It's intended to be a forum for you to ask questions, to clarify points that I may have made in what you think is a muddled way, or if it is, anything that's unclear, you're supposed to bring to the tutorium, and this can then be hopefully clarified there. It is also one way for you to give feedback to me. Okay. If you think that what I'm doing here is really extremely confusing and you really think that something ought to be changed, and you feel that you wouldn't like to talk to me in person, which you're welcome to do, then, for example, you could let the tutorial teachers know. Okay. I will also ask them in regularly, what do they say? Okay. Do they moan? Do they love it? Do they whatever? Okay. So this is one way of giving feedback as well. They run in the evenings because this means that there are fewer clashes with other courses. 18 to 20 isn't actually the time that they run, because they are 1 hour tutorials. Okay? But we've reserved the rooms for 2 hours, and in fact there is a certain freedom in moving something, let's say, to 6:30 to 7:30, if everyone wants that and the person responsible for the tutorial is actually able to do this. Now, some of the people responsible for the tutorials are actually here. Can I just sort of ask you to indicate who you are? Okay. So these are students. Yes. Get up and wave, I said. But, okay, it was just waving, but anyway, it doesn't matter. They're students. They're more advanced students in higher semesters who've done very well in linguistics and therefore are clearly well equipped to act as tutorial teachers. Okay. Good. And some of them have done it last year already, or did it last year, and are doing it again. Okay. Now, if you want to attend any of those tutorials, you need to please sign up to them via LSF. Okay. And the window for doing so is very short. Okay. It's only from the 1st to the 3rd of November. Okay. So, Monday to Wednesday. If you miss this, then yes, there will be a way of getting you in. But please don't send, if 100 people come afterwards and say, can you please add me? It basically means that we have to do it manually with your matricul number, etc. So please make sure that if you want to attend the tutorials, you sign up to whatever slot is suitable for you. There are tutorials on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday. There are 2 tutorials on Wednesday. There is nothing on Friday evening because we thought it was already difficult to get you all here on a Friday afternoon. But more about getting you all here in a minute. Okay, the lecture schedule, depending on where you live, will be uploaded to StudIP. So you can look at what's happening next week. The lecture schedule also lists the compulsory reading in the textbook that I'm going to introduce in a few minutes. Okay. Only additional readings which are not yet set will be mentioned in the lectures themselves. I will not usually remind you of the obligatory reading or the compulsory readings. You're supposed to take care of that yourself. Okay. There will be exercises, and I will announce those in the lecture. These exercises are meant to be not compulsory, but they are meant as preparation for tutorials, etc., or for yourself, and they're not part of the assignment. Okay. Right, then there is Christmas. There is no lecture on the 24th of December, of course not. But I had to decide whether I wanted to condense everything into 14 lectures or whether I wanted to keep the 15th lecture, which is actually the 4th lecture on syntax, which does not, this is now going to be very dangerous what I'm saying, which is not absolutely essential for passing the basic requirements. Okay? However, it is clearly an integral part of the lecture course, and it would be, I don't think it would be a good idea to ignore it. Okay? Really. Okay. So what I've decided to do is that I'm going to put last year's lecture, which was the 4th lecture on syntax, online for you to listen to. There will be no tasks associated with this that count as part of the credit points, etc. But it would. I also asked the tutorial teachers, would you think it's a good idea to condense the 4 lectures into 3 on syntax? And they just shook their head. Okay. So I think it's easier on you if we do it like that. Right. Then there is the dreaded exam at the end. Okay. Last year, people asked me, can you tell us something about the exam? And I said, oh no, that's going to be long in the future, let's not do it. This time I'm going to say something about the exam very, very early on. First of all, the date. It's going to take place on the 5th of April, 2011. Sorry, I don't know whether it's in the morning or in the afternoon, but I don't think that's going to be a problem. Okay. Now, I was debating how much I should tell you about the exam, and also how much I should tell you about how last year's batch of students did in the exam. Because I have to admit, I was really quite disappointed. More than 50% of people taking the exam failed the exam in the first attempt. This is not, I think, because we are trying to be nasty and we're trying to reduce the numbers and all those rumors that you probably have heard about what happens at university. We sincerely think that the exam was not a particularly difficult, and we also think that it is that it was a fair exam. In fact, you could answer all the questions in the exam if you knew the bold-faced concepts in the list that I distributed. Okay. But still, more than 50% failed in the exam. And they had to retake it, and in fact, some of them had to retake it a third time. Now, I'm not telling this to you to scare you off or to get you too concerned about this. I really, really think it's doable. And it's not just doable. It should really be no problem, I think. But it is going to be a problem if you don't keep up with what's happening during the semester. If you find yourself revising for the exam within, let's say, the last 4 or 5 weeks before the exam, you're going to find it really, really hard. Okay. I was actually going to get someone from last year to give you a report on this. In the end, I decided against that. Just please believe me, you make your own life a lot easier if you keep up with the reading, and if you do the exercises, and if you constantly assess where you are in the progress, rather than keeping things for a while and looking at it later. Because you actually have one exam that covers 3 areas, TESOL and literature and linguistics, if you are a B.Ed. or a B.A. major student. Okay. So, as I said, this is not meant to scare you off, but I really wanted to make that point very, very clearly. There is a lot of information coming your way. Now, the good news is, for many, I think, that the lectures are being recorded. I will make a link available to all 15 lectures. You will be able to listen to the lecture. You will be able to see the slides at the same time. You won't be able to see me, but I think you can do without that. Okay? So you will basically have the lecture without me sort of constantly pacing up and down. And this will be available after the end of the term. Okay. You can log into StudIP with your usual UniTrio login to get access to this information. In fact, last year I put it on my homepage, and I'll probably do this again this year. Okay. Now, this means that you do not have to be here if you don't want to. People tell me that they found it easier last year when they were here rather than when they only listened to the lecture. Okay. I will leave that up to you. Okay. I like to have a lot of people to talk to, but I'm also happy to do this for a somewhat smaller crowd. Okay. It's entirely up to you, and it makes it a little bit more flexible for you as well, I think. Okay. What I would not do is say, it's all recorded, and, well, I'll listen to all of it at the end. As I said, that doesn't work. Now, this statement is also valid for the people in the old Studiengänge. Okay? If you're a Magister or Staatsexamen student who just need a Testat, then it also means that you do not have to be present physically in order to get that Testat. All right. The next point is going to cause some concern. I already know. Right. The textbook. for this lecture and for the next lecture. No, not next lecture, sorry. For this lecture course and for the lecture course next term with Dr. Schaefer, we use the same textbook. It's Edward Finnegan's Language, Its Structure and Use. Many of the readings, if not most of the readings, will be out of this book, and many of the exercises which I will be setting as optional exercises will be out of this book. Now, this book is expensive. Okay? And I really mean expensive. I decided I'm not going to put this here because, okay, and some copies are available from Stefanos and Trev. I'm not even going to, well, I'm going to mention in the end how much it is, but let me give you the important information first. The library has more than 50, I think, copies of the book. Okay? And I have put, I think, 25, if not more, on presents. Which means that you can take it home for a day, or rather a night. Okay? But you cannot take it away with you for weeks and months. Now, there are about 300 of you, a little bit more. We have 50 copies. The majority of these, slightly, well, at least half of them, are more or less constantly available in the library. Okay. And the library spent a lot of money on those. Okay. So, I would think that if you want the book, this is a good idea. It's going to be a book that's going to be with you for a whole year. It's going to be a book that you can refer back to. But if you are worried about the price, which is above 60 euros, okay, thank you. Okay. I know, it's bizarre. I mean, I agree. It is very expensive. And it's not just that it's expensive in Germany. If you buy the book in the United States, I think it's $112. I mean, it's... Yeah. I'm not sure how they get away with it. Okay. And that's one of the reasons why we decided to make so many copies available to you. Okay. The book may also be available secondhand from students from previous years, of course. Now last year the uproar was much bigger, but that's probably because I didn't make the important points first. But anyway, the book does not replace the lecture. Very, very important point. I will be saying many things in the lectures that are not in Finnegan. Finnegan and the lectures complement each other. There is a lot of overlap in many ways. But I will be saying things that sometimes may even contradict what's in Finnegan, and I will point this out. And I will say why there are good reasons to do this. Okay, another minor point. How do you address me in emails? Okay. I get a lot of emails. And I get a lot of emails with ways of addressing which are a bit odd. I get, "Dear Mr. Professor Dr. Hoffmann," okay? Which is basically a straight translation from "Sehr geehrter Herr Professor Dr. Hoffmann." Or I get, "Dear Professor Dr. Hoffmann." All right, there's the Mr. gone. I once in Lancaster, I have to say I never got this here, I got, "Hey, Prof." And I wasn't even a prof back then, but anyway, yeah. Sometimes I get, "Dear Professor Hoffmann." I get, "Dear Mr. Hoffmann." I get, "Hi" or "Hello." Okay. Now, this sort of assumes that you want to write in English, which, by the way, you are welcome to do, but you're not obliged to do. I don't mind what you write to me. You can write in English, you can write in German. I know that from people in the Sprachpraxis, you're encouraged to write in English, certainly to them, and that may be the default assumption. I don't mind. Whatever you feel more comfortable with, I don't mind. If you write in English, then maybe the first three are not a good idea. Okay. The first one is not a good idea because it's simply a wrong translation word by word from English. You don't do this because you only use the highest title if you want to use the title. I'm perfectly happy with Dear Mr. Hoffman. You don't have to be specifically formal or especially formal only because there are four extra letters in front of my name. Okay. If you write in German, if you absolutely must insist on being formal, fine. If you write to me with this, then you're going to get back sehr geehrte Frau or sehr geehrte Herr X. Okay. No problem. You can write, lieber Herr Hoffmann. You can write, hallo Herr Hoffmann. You can write lots of things, okay? Basically, my message is you get back from me what you write to me, okay? Okay. I used to live in the north of England, and in England the situation is very different because you're all on first name basis. Obviously, you can't do this in the German system because we have the du and sie, and it's just a different cultural setting as well. But you do not have to be particularly formal. Right. A point about using email addresses, or which email addresses. You are welcome to use your private email addresses, gmx, web.de, whatever, okay, to me. Yeah? But you absolutely must check your official university mail address. You will receive from time to time information from me via email because I'm clicking on a button in StudIP or LSF and that says send to everybody. You won't get it if you don't check your university email address. There is an option to forward mail that gets to your official email address to your private one. The Rechenzentrum or whatever it is called now, TIMC or whatever, will be happy to help you if you don't find out yourself. Right, we're almost there. A note on discipline. Okay. I find it quite funny that I have to do this. But anyway, this is a lecture. Okay, I'm saying this slightly tongue-in-cheek. This is not the cinema. This is not your sofa at home. This is not the Mensa, etc. In fact, if you're being loud in a cinema, then you're probably being shushed by others around you. Okay. I had quite a few problems last term with people chatting in the lecture. Not about linguistics, I'm 99% sure. Okay. Now, yes, I just said that language is a very important part of our lives, and it's, we like to communicate, but please not in the lecture, and even more so because your presence isn't required. I will not take it personal if you're not here. If you feel that you are communicative today and you would like to chat to your neighbor, then please don't come. I'm going to be strict this term than I was last year. And the reason, basically, is that it is in the interest of those people who want to listen. Because they get disturbed. I also get disturbed sometimes and I lose my thread. Okay. So I just wanted to say this at the outset. In a way, this is treating you like little children. I apologize for this. Okay, we are no longer at school, but I think this is an important point. Okay. Do you think it's over? Not quite, not quite. I have a little story. I just said I don't treat you like children, and I do not intend to do that. But still, I would like to read you a little children's story. And I would like to do that because there are many aspects in that little children's story that actually relate to linguistics. It's the story of grain theft. Okay? I'll just put this a little bit down. Okay, let's see. Can you see that? brain cell was so brainy, he talked in riddles and rhyme. When people tried to solve them, it took up lots of time. 1.5 hours, usually. Okay. If a door is ajar, can a jar be a door? Do waves wave goodbye when they leave the seashore? Can you tie a rainbow? Or see a moonbeam? Can you eat jellyfish? Yes, if you live in some parts of the world. Yes. Or can you hear ice cream? Do snowmen dress up to dance at snowballs? Will the pleasure boat trip when the water falls? Okay. Word boundaries, structure of words, morphology. Okay. Will the bread run out? When the butterflies? Can you see the sunflower? Or eat magpies? Does a dogfish? There's a dogfish. Does a cowslip? Can a horse fly? Or a sheep dip? Brain cell told them all, each person and creature. They could learn these things if he was their teacher. Bat said, fantastic. Bug said, oh great. Aardvark and zebra said, you've got a date. So they sat in his classroom and all called him Prof. And he talked, till they all nodded off. So, see you next Friday.